This week marks 50 years since the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. His death came nearly 5 years after he gave his iconic I Have a Dream speech at the March on Washington.
I am happy to join.
King was just 34 when he gave that speech, and many of the activists he was inspiring were even younger. Hugh Price was one of them.
I served as a marshal in the March on Washington in 1963. If someone acted up and tried to disrupt things, we were supposed to surround them, hold hands, and call the cops. We weren't trained to engage physically, but we were trained to isolate and then to try to hold that person in place until better trained security arrived.
Price would go on to serve as president and CEO of the National Urban League. He says the March on Washington is what sparked his lifelong devotion to social justice.
That day inspired me to make the anti-poverty movements and civil rights movements my life's work.
1963 is not an end, but a beginning.
Today, grassroots activism is once again springing up all around the country, and the issues that are compelling people to take action are not all that different from the ones that Dr. King and his contemporaries focused on. To get a sense of what's changed for young activists since 1968 and what's stayed the same, I spoke to Hugh Price alongside Opal Tometi, co-founder of Black Lives Matter.
What's interesting to realize that the civil rights movement, as we know it, was essentially a Southern movement focused on voting rights, integrating lunch counters, etc. That was a movement driven by the church, driven by Martin Luther King, the Southern Leadership Conference, etc. It was kind of a different dynamic north of the Mason-Dixon line, where much of the emphasis was on jobs, on the repair of communities that had been destroyed by urban renewal, police brutality, which of course was faced in the South by demonstrators as well. And actually, Martin Luther King came north to Cicero outside of Chicago to try to deal with racial discrimination in housing, and he did not really get much traction there.
Well, this is a terrible thing. I've been in many demonstrations all across the South, but I can say that I have never seen, even in Mississippi and Alabama, mobs as hostile and as hate-filled as I've seen in Chicago.
We also must remember that the quote-unquote protests in the 60s sort of went over the top and became quite violent and led to the riots that afflicted many cities across the country, and that left a lot of destruction in the wake of the very neighborhoods where the protests were centered. Another thing that's interesting looking back then as well as today is that there are a number of different major movements intersecting around the same time. The anti-Vietnam War movement was definitely percolating. The women's lib movement was percolating. And then, of course, there was the northern movement in cities and the southern movement in around civil rights issues in the South. So it was a turbulent time then, so much so that the FBI had its COINTELPRO program, and they were infiltrating and wiretapping. My family and I were actually victims of wiretapping.
So they tapped your phone.
They tapped our phone. We could hear the machinery clicking on when we'd pick up our phone, and my wife and I would say, you're not going to hear anything interesting, so you might as well hang up now. So that was going, disintermediation was going on then, designed to destabilize, to distract, and to discredit.
So Opal, if we could link it back to Martin Luther King, I mean, so we are honoring his life and also remembering the fact that he was assassinated. How were you using the lessons that you learned by studying his life in your current work, leading some of these movements, Black Lives Matter, and also your work with immigration?
So the legacy of Dr. King is multifaceted. And if we are to really examine his life and the trajectory and even the evolution of his politics and his contributions to the civil rights movement, I think we'll see that he increasingly became more and more concerned about those who are more marginalized, those who might be living in different countries around the world, those who might be impacted by war, poverty, and so on. And so I think that our social movements of today are picking up in many ways where our predecessors, you know, left off, and are really building off of the lessons that we learned from that time.
As you look across the eras, there are a number of differences today that have made the contemporary movements even more powerful than those in the past. I mean, the advent of social media and the ability to organize mass protests on what appears to be the spur of the moment. You don't need months of preparation. If you look at the recent March for Our Lives by all the young people who are protesting the gun situation in this country. Just the ability to do that, the Women's March right after the inauguration, the ability to turn up, you know, hundreds of thousands of people on fairly short notice is extraordinary. The fact that many of these movements are not led by established organizations and high-profile leaders, but are deeply rooted in communities, it's sort of a new phenomenon. The advent of the cell phone. Now with the cell phone, there often is firsthand evidence. The sheer youth of those protesters is a new development. Having kids from middle school, high school, not just college, on the front lines, giving speeches, appealing to legislators, that's a new phenomenon compared to times past, and it potentially is a very powerful one.
So, Opal, what are you experiencing on the street? I know that you work in areas of a lot of intersection with immigration, but also the Black Lives Matter movement.
The reality is that racism isn't new. And the civil rights movements of yesterday and the human rights movements of today share very similar goals, right? I'm really concerned about the creation of this new term and framework of Black identity extremists that the FBI is using in order to criticize our movements, demonize our movements, and really criminalize them, essentially looking at us as though we are terrorists for having the audacity to organize ourselves, the audacity to say being Black is not a crime, and having the audacity to ultimately say that, you know, Black lives matter.
This week obviously marks the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s death. How much progress do you think America has made since he passed away?
Well, I do not want to ever come off as cynical, but we can't be concerned only about who killed Dr. King, but also about what killed Dr. King. And what killed Dr. King is still alive, and we see it every day. You know, we see it's what killed Ayanna Stanley Jones, it's what killed Alton Sterling, and it's what's devastating even Black immigrant communities across the country. And that's white supremacy. And it's not only killing our communities, but it's eroding any progress that we have made towards a more just and inclusive society. And so I do believe that we have a long way to go. And I'm looking to my mentors and elders to show us some of their lessons, to share with us. And I'm looking forward to organizing and working across generations and with more young people to also innovate on our strategies to ensure that we have the type of multiracial democracy that works for all of us.
Hugh, for the young people out there who are listening, who want to get involved, having lived through King's assassination, what advice do you give those young activists?
First, I'd say looking back on the 50th anniversary of King's assassination, I would say that he was an incandescently charismatic leader. Incandescently charismatic leaders are accidents of history. You can't groom them, grow them, or send them to graduate school to become those kinds of leaders. So in their absence, you have to have a strong, sustained ground game, which consists of organizations in communities pressing the agenda, mobilizing, putting together legislative action plans, doing voter registration, voter turnout. That's the hard work of the ground game. In many respects, I think my generation should step aside, stop sucking air out of the leadership arena, stand on the sidelines and cheer. And the younger generation's got to take over. This is their world.
Hugh Price, former president and CEO of the National Urban League. Thank you.
Thank you.
Opal Temeti, executive director of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration and a co-founder of Black Lives Matter. Thank you, Opal.
Thank you.